JFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Reporters Roundtable. WJFF's Patricia Rubio sat down virtually with local reporters Liam Mayo with the River Reporter, Chris Rowley with the Shawangunk Journal, and Joe Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat to discuss local issues affecting our region in another edition of the Reporters Roundtable. Plus, it is our annual music sale, and Jason Dole is there live. Jason, are people lining up?
Yes, there are already people here. There have been people here for well over a half hour when I arrived. There's already folks waiting, and the records are waiting, too. We have thousands and thousands of records, as well as CDs, instruments, and more, all here waiting for folks when the doors open at 11.
And we'll get a preview of more of the items available at the music sale right after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. National Institutes of Health Director Dr. Francis Collins says the new coronavirus variant, first discovered in South Africa, is getting a lot of attention for good reason.
It's a troubling variant. It has more than 50 mutations, the largest number of differences from the original virus that we've seen so far. And that, of course, makes you worry that the things that we've been doing to fight this off might not work quite as well. Well,
Collins says there is no data just yet to suggest that current vaccines will not be effective against the new variant. UK's health minister says two cases of what's being called the Omicron variant have been detected in Britain, saying today that both are linked to travel to southern Africa. The health ministry says the two individuals and all members of their households have been told to self-isolate while further testing and contact tracing are being conducted. Federal health officials say Omicron has not yet been detected in the United States, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is seeking to reassure Americans, saying last night there are surveillance systems in place that should quickly identify the Omicron variant. The list of countries imposing travel restrictions on countries in southern Africa is growing, the moves in effort to contain the Omicron variant. Dan Karpinchuk reports that Canada joining several countries, including the U.S., and banning entry to foreign nationals who have recently traveled through southern Africa.
The ban covers travelers who have been to seven southern African countries in the last 2 weeks. In addition, the Department of Foreign Affairs is urging any Canadians in those countries to leave. With no direct flights from the region, Canadians or permanent residents returning to Canada must take COVID-19 tests in a third country and will also be tested upon arrival at their final destination. Canada's Chief Public Health Officer, Theresa Tam, says for now there are no indications the variant has arrived in Canada. Tam says the variant could be highly transmissible and possibly more resistant to vaccines. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
To Florida now, where officials say tourism has returned to levels not seen since the beginning of the pandemic. NPR's Greg Allen reports the recovery has been driven by an increase in domestic visitors.
With U.S. borders closed to most foreign visitors because of the pandemic, Florida's state-funded tourism agency launched an ad campaign targeting people within driving distance. Officials say the campaign paid off because it was the only state marketing to visitors outside its borders. Visitation began rebounding in 2020 and now has exceeded pre-pandemic levels. More than 31 million people traveled to Florida from July to September, slightly more than seen in 2019 before the pandemic. Now that the U.S. border has been reopened to international visitors, Florida officials are expecting a surge that will push tourism, a mainstay of the state economy, to record levels. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
And you're listening to NPR News. The Food and Drug Administration has posted its review of Merck's experimental COVID-19 pill, saying it's effective, but there are concerns about its safety for pregnant women. An outside panel of experts is set to meet next week as the FDA considers authorizing the medication. China has issued an arrest warrant for one of the region of Macau's biggest casino junket operators. NPR's Emily Fang reports that the suspect, Alvin Chow, allegedly had gaming operations on mainland China.
Gambling is illegal in mainland China, but it is allowed in Macau, where massive casinos and junkets for VIP guests once brought in tens of billions of dollars. It also was a center of money laundering and came under scrutiny as China began a series of anti-corruption campaigns. Alvin Chow runs Sun City, one of the biggest Macau junket operators, and has faced legal trouble before. In 2019, when China State News Agency accused him of luring mainland gamblers, he managed to evade punishment. This time, Chinese authorities are coming after him for a mainland China operation they say had 80,000 gamblers. They also say Chow and a collaborator assisted gamblers with money transfers and helped collect on debts. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beijing.
Stephen Sondheim is being remembered today as one of musical theater's greatest songwriters. Sondheim died yesterday at age 91. Six of his musicals won Tony Awards for Best Score. He also received a Pulitzer Prize for Sunday in the Park, an Academy Award for the song Sooner or Later from the Dick Tracy film, 5 Olivier Awards, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, thanking the people who make public radio great every day, and also those who listen.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We have the Reporters Roundtable for the month of November coming up with Patricia Rubio. But first, we're going to check in with our own Jason Dole, who's at the White Sulphur Springs Fire Hall for our annual music sale. Jason, how are you doing?
Doing great. And, you know, the volunteers who run this music sale are here putting some final touches on things, checking out some final items, making everything just perfect for what we anticipate to be a wave of people to come through and devour it and just pull everything apart and take it all home with them, because that's what it's here for.
Yeah, and you said there are folks already lining up outside and that there's a lot of stuff inside.
They did, because it is so cold. They let the front part of the line come right on up the entrance hallway, okay. So they're not out in the cold, and it's only a few people so far. And they've got their masks on, and they're talking music.
Yeah, masks required inside today. You said you've been doing some math with the number of records on offer there. What have you come up with?
So, not including the classical section of LPs, I counted some 48 boxes of records on the main floor. I came up with about 3,300 records, just estimating, counting a couple boxes and multiplying up. And that's just, again, for the main floor records. That's not the high-value records. That's not the classical. So there's probably in excess of 5,000 records here. And then, of course, there's a whole display of 8-track cassettes. there's probably as many CDs as there are records here. And then the music and then all the stereo equipment, too. So it's great. It's like it's different every year, but it's always the same great sort of thing.
Yeah, I was there yesterday with you and the volunteers that are doing such a great job getting that all together year-round, really. Got to thank John and Kurt and Nick and David for their work. And then we have other volunteers that came in yesterday to help get it all out for everybody. I noticed that 8-track collection. It looked like there was a country music fan there with those 8-track tapes.
Yeah, and it looked like there was like one case of real classic 70s rock, like Led Zeppelin and Cheap Trick 8-tracks that they put on the other side of the room, I guess, to separate the rock and country so they don't get into a fight or something.
Yeah, there's no brawl over those.
Yeah. And you know, the book section looks phenomenal.
Well, you know, I will say that I did help do that with, along with our intern Annika. We did try to organize the books.
Well, the next time I come on, I'll tell you some of the things that'll be on the silent auction, because there's always some nice instruments and devices in the silent auction section.
Right, we've got that, and we've got all of the other equipment and musical instruments. We'll talk about those in a little bit. Again, the White Sulphur Springs Fire Hall is the site of our annual music sale. It returns this year, starts at 11 in less than an hour, goes until 3, masks required indoors. We're also selling our Radio Catskill t-shirts there, and there's just a lot of great stuff. It's a great community event while you're out in the community for Small Business Saturday. Stop by and grab some great goods. Jason, we'll check in with you later.
All right, thanks so much.
On Radio Chatskill today, we are talking to our local reporters. WJFF's Patricia Rubio has the November edition of Reporters Roundtable. This month, they're looking again at the recent election and an update on cannabis sales within the county, among other topics. Patricia talked with Liam Mayo of the River Reporter, Chris Rowley with the Shawangunk Journal, and Joe Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat.
Hi, welcome to another edition of the Reporters Roundtable. It's November 2021. Today I'm joined by Leah Mayo of the River Reporter, Joseph Abraham, managing editor for the Sullivan County Democrat, and Chris Raleigh from the Shawangunk Journal. And today we'll be talking about local topics, recent election results, and the ongoing cannabis discussion that's happening within counties. Now, Joe, this wasn't a big election year, no presidential year, no state senators that were running. How was the turnout in Sullivan County?
Yeah, Sullivan County is pretty interesting. We had a lot of uncontested races, seven of which were contested. The closest race is actually down in the town of Highland between Jeff Haas, the incumbent, and challenger Johnny Pizzolatto, who's very active with the Greater Berryville Chamber of Commerce. They're separated by 25 votes. Then town of Thompson is separated by 76 votes between incumbent supervisor Bill Reber and Scott Mace, who's a challenger, who is been a town of Thompson councilman for close to a decade. And the one that everyone's had their eyes on in Sullivan County is the town of Fallsburg, which I know you know very well because you covered both Thompson and Fallsburg for the Democrat. Steve Iglanti had a 400-plus vote lead, the incumbent over Catherine Jean Rappaport, challenger on election night. But the big story here is that there's close to 1,000 absentee ballots that have to be counted in that race, and they're beginning that Board of Elections soon. But that's, you know, no 400-vote lead is safe when you have that many absentee ballots. So that's sort of been the big story locally, is that looking at those three races mainly because of the fact that, you know, both, you know, Bill Reber's probably the safest of the three with the 76 vote lead, because Thompson doesn't have nearly as many absentees. They have like 143 or four to count. So it'd be very hard. And typically they say that absentee ballots, unless you get like a big block vote thing, tend to follow the trend of the general election and the voting as far as the numbers. So I think he's pretty safe. The Highland one will be interesting because 25 votes is not a lot of votes to lead by, but the big one is Fallsburg. And then the only real upset that we had, and I call it an upset whenever you have a challenger defeat an incumbent, is in the town of Mamikating, which is Mike Robbins, who's like a local businessman and I think a firefighter out of Bloomingburg, who defeated the incumbent supervisor, Janet Leibold. So that's sort of the only upset that we had. But you know, we'll have to see what those other three races that I mentioned.
Right. And how about you, Liam? What are you seeing in your end?
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of the similar things. I'm paying pretty close attention to Highland. That's been a contentious election as far back as the primaries. There was some contention around Johnny Pizzolatto getting the Democratic endorsement for the election. And currently, like Joe said, he's got a very small lead. And one of his running mates on the council side, Laura Burrell, is 9 votes behind someone she's running against. So there are, I think, 67 absentee ballots as of November 5, which is a little while ago. So more may have come in since then. So both of those, the entire race in that town is really, really close. But yeah, a couple of town council seats shifted hands in Tustin, a few in Keshecton, and a few in Bethel, I believe, or one in Bethel. And other than that, I think we're just waiting for the absentee ballots to come in. Like Joe said, looking at Thompson, looking at Fallsburg, looking at Highland, and waiting to see what's going to happen there.
In Sullivan County, we had a couple of key races there. Liam, do you think some of those key races were able to convert turnout? Were they able to bring out the people to vote?
Yeah, I was just going to mention that I had checked the numbers back on November 5, absentee ballots plus general election ballots that had come in up until then. That's November 5, so there are probably more since. Right. And that was 15,748 which is a pretty decent turnout. In 2019, there were 16,867. So wow. It's a little down from the last local election, but 1,000 votes here and there is a pretty... It's a sizable difference, but not
right.
Drastic. It's not a drastically lower turnout than last time.
How about you, Joe? Do you get a sense of the turnout was better or worse than last year? Did you visit any of the polling sites?
Yeah, we had one of our reporters visited a few of the polling sites. It was pretty slow, just the time of days that he went. Just a couple of notes in Highland. I don't know if I misspoke earlier or not, but it's actually Jeff Hoff, the incumbent, that leads Johnny by 25 votes currently. But as far as turnout goes, you know, people also have to remember that there were no last year we had a presidential election. So a lot more people tend to come to the polls when they want to vote for those big races. We also didn't have any, you know, state Senate or U.S. Congress races or whatever. So those are all factors that just play into the role of turnout. I do know as far as additional numbers that 908 people took advantage of early voting in Sullivan County. I'm not sure how that compares to previous years, but it seems like a pretty sizable number of people to me. So,
right. And Chris, how about you? How were the races in your area and how was the turnout?
Turnout was, for this kind of race, turnout was pretty feeble, I would say. But, you know, Ulster County continues its move towards the Democrats. They picked up more seats. The county legislature is now pretty firmly Democratic. On the local level here, well, we're seeing a slight shuffle on the town board. Town supervisor came back with no problems. He won 60% of the vote. But the Roger Buckwalter has lost his seat. He'll be replaced by Bill Brown and another Democrat. And on the village board, there was a change, and there will be another change because while there was one seat that changed the election, two seats changed, actually. One seat will go to T.J. Briggs, who is moving across from the town board to the village board. Another seat will probably go to Susan Nyby, but she has a rather slender lead of about 20 votes as we wait for the absentee ballots to be counted. And that will be the end of Darcen McComb's tenure on that seat. Meanwhile, Francisco Oliveira has tendered his resignation and left. And that means that there will be another seat on the village board to be appointed probably in the next month. So, you know, a bit of a shakeup on the village board. And we'll see. But, you know, turnout wasn't fantastic. And in our particular legislature seats, county legislature seats didn't change. Craig Lopez continues to hold the 14th and the 15th stay the same as well. So pretty much steady right. state there.
Right.
But at the county level overall, that's a shift towards the Democrats, which is something that's been going on for 20 years.
A shift towards the Democrats.
Yeah.
Joe, what do you think? Is that happening here in Sullivan County? Is it leading more towards Democratic or is it leading more towards Republican? As of late, I don't know, we've seen the races lean towards more Republican than Democrat.
I would say that it depends where you are in the county. I would say typically your urban centers of, you know, as far as more populated town of Fallsburg, village of Monticello, you know, have been more Democrat leaning. Liberty has been a little more 50-50. And then the further west you go in the past, it would be a little more conservative. However, I would say that's shifting to being more Democratic by all the second homeowners who are coming here full time from the city. I will say, though, your opinion is not misplaced because it would seem that way because the Republicans have held the majority in our legislature the last two sessions. But I don't know if that's saying much more that there are necessarily less Democrats. It's just a matter, number one, of who's coming out to vote and also which political party locally has done a better job at getting their candidates elected. But I wouldn't. So that's why I think the optics might be there that that's the case. But I I think like you're looking at places like Coshocton town of Delaware and stuff, we're actually seeing more people who've made Sullivan County their home running on the Democratic ticket or trying to get elected.
And how about you, Liam? Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I feel pretty similarly. And at least from what I've seen, there is a large second homeowner influence and a lot of new energy coming into the area that leans Democratic. And how that influences politics is varying town by town. Cambry Cruz was running as a Democrat in Coshocton as sort of a new energy, and she may still get on the board. I believe she's 10 votes behind John Nober, a Republican, with 24 absentee ballots or so to count. It's unlikely but possible. But in that same race, the Democratic candidate, Paul Salzberg, a longtime country doctor, lost his seat. So if she doesn't win, Coshocton's town board is going to be fully Republicans. And then we have over in Tustin, every Democratic candidate running for their seat has made it in by a fairly comfortable margin. So we've got the completely opposite happening there. The town board will have a Democratic majority going forward. And then we go down to Highland, and it's very 50-50. The race between Haas and Pizzolatto is very, very close, with Haas sort of coming out ahead for the moment, at least. Before the absentee ballots are counted. And just it'll be interesting to see where that kind of goes. So I think there is kind of that second homeowner Democratic energy starting to have its impact now on the area. But how much impact, I think, remains to be seen.
Listening to the Reporters Roundtable with WJFF's Patricia Roballo and local journalists from the region. We'll get more from them, and we'll also check in with Jason Dole at the annual music sale that's getting underway in White Sulphur Springs after a short break. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
This Week in This American Life.
Being so close to these birds that don't normally allow us to get that close to them was like passing through some kind of force field or something and emerging on their side of the divide and feeling that.
A flock of birds changes one man's life. And other birds changing other people's lives this week.
Saturday at 6 on Radio Catskill.
The hamlet of Calicoon transforms into a Victorian holiday wonderland for Dickens on the Delaware. Saturday, December 11th from noon to 8. Caroling, horse and buggy rides, theater and dance performances, shopkeepers dressed in Victorian garb, and more. Dickens on the Delaware, Saturday, December 11th. More information on the Dickens on the Delaware Facebook event page. Paid for by the Calicoon Business Association.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today is our annual music sale at the White Sulphur Springs Fire Hall, and we're checking in live with our own Jason Dole. Jason, how are you doing?
Doing good, doing good.
Let's set the scene for folks who may not have been there. When you walk into the fire hall, it's jam-packed with tables full of records, which we mentioned during our last break. But sort of in the back, you've got the whole silent auction going on and some like high-value items as well.
Yeah, so the first thing that you encounter is, you know, the check-in counter where people pay the admission to get in, and I think it's also where we'll have T-shirts for sale, and that's where people pay when they check out, once they've grabbed some things to get. And then, yes, in the back we've got the high-value section. Just means some records that are worth a bit more than the dollar per record that all the other records in the building are worth, and by more I mean, you know, a little bit more. They're all there. And then on the silent auction table, this is where we've got some of the nicer instruments, some of the guitars. There's a bass guitar, electric guitar, a nice accordion, and some devices, and as well, like I think at least one or two of the nicer receivers are in the silent auction. as well as a random tone generator.
Oh, wow.
That lights up. We don't know if it makes tones, but it definitely lights up. Vintage gear that people want just for decor value. But
you know, I think
somebody might want to generate some tones.
Yeah, I think I saw a vintage radio there, too, like in a Bakelite setting.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so weird. After you've been to as many of these as I have, you start thinking, like, oh, man, is that the same one? You know, like, 'cause you feel like there's always one like that at one of these sales, you know?
Uh-huh. And I think that also back there, there's this, I noticed there was a keyboard, there's some amps, various guitars. I believe there's a cello.
Yeah, and like some of these instruments, like I said, are in the silent auction, but not all. There are plenty of things here that are literally priced to move, meaning, you know what, for a few dollars, whatever it happens to be. We got a very nice vintage multivox organ that appears to work, but it needs a little soldering. So that's going to be something that gets sold as is, you know, and priced accordingly.
To move. As you said, we want to get this stuff out, and we want to make sure that folks get there and take something home with them, whether it's that project or some of your favorite vinyl. We've got all genres represented, classical, pop, rock, and also some what do we call those ones on the wall?
I think we call them the wall records. I call them the kitschy record sleeves. Like you definitely want to take a look at the wainscoting, the tiny little shelf going all the way around. Some of the weirder record covers, kitschier record covers that they've encountered are up on the wall for you to look at, and then also buy, because those are all a dollar each, like all every other record in the building that isn't priced higher than that.
Some of them are just for the laugh value alone. I think there was Music to Paint By.
Yeah.
I think I saw...
There was Music to Live By.
To Live By, yeah. And that one, I don't know if you noticed that one, but like it looks like the worst living situation ever. The family that's sitting there, it's like, oh, I don't want to live by this music
family
with these people.
Time. Yeah.
Yeah, the kids look very troubled in that photo. All right, so the music sale doors are opening in just a little over a half an hour. It's at the White Sulphur Springs Fire Hall. Masks are required indoors at the event. It's at 3352 Route 52, just down the road in White Sulphur Springs. And you'll get to see Jason, you'll get to see the volunteers, and you'll get to see a lot of great merchandise to take home, vinyl, audio equipment and stereo equipment, and some musical instruments too, as well as our new t-shirts. Jason, we'll check in with you one more time before we open the doors.
Okay, that sounds good.
All right, and we're going to get back to Radio Chatskill with the Reporters Roundtable. Every month, WJFF's Patricia Roballo sits down with local reporters to talk about issues affecting our listening area. Today, he's speaking with Liam Mayo of the River Reporter, Chris Rowley of the Shawangunk Journal, and Joe Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat.
Now, the winter is coming, and the winter weather brings cold weather, and it brings people indoors. And last year, we had a surge during the winter. And this year, it seems like there's another surge coming, even though we have a vaccine. Chris, what is the outlook in Ulster County and where you are with the vaccine and positive cases now?
Well, I'm just going to bring up here. I'm just going to quickly look here at the website and the dashboard. We have 523 cases active, 292 fatalities total, and there is this little uptick, which is worrying. And it's kind of interesting because in the summer it was virtually over. You know, back in July we had two cases. Then it rose up through, the end of August into September, dropped again in October, as I think we had this sort of vaccination effect. As more and more people got vaccinated, case loads dropped. But now tracking almost exactly with the decline in temperature at the second half, into November, as it's gone down, so active cases have risen. And I suspect that's mostly the unvaccinated. And that's a little alarming because, I mean, I think New York and Ulster County has been pretty good on vaccination, but there's still quite a few people out there who are resistant for one reason or another. And I fear that, they're going to get it. And they may have a very bad time as a result. You know, I mean, everything I've ever heard about this I mean, I got the booster on Friday. Okay. I'm an older guy. I wasn't going to mess around with this any further, you know, and I will take another booster as soon as it's required. I think being unvaccinated at this point is kind of like Russian roulette, you know, so it's going to go that way. And as we go indoors more, as we come to Thanksgiving and Christmas and the other holidays, so we're going to see, what can we call it? A bloom of cases. Yeah. And unfortunately, there will be some that will die. And it seems to me extremely unnecessary.
Right. Do you think that masking has something to do with that? That the sort of, the easing of masking, has maybe an effect on the rise? Because it seems like, I don't know, in my personal view, in some of the events I've seen online or the events I've been to, masks are not, no longer sort of a thing to do. I mean, obviously in stores, it's still there, but obviously in outdoor events, you know, masks are here and there, but it seems that there's less of it.
Well, look, with masking, this is a respiratory disease that moves around on droplets. The virus is in droplets of spit, the stuff that comes out of us, right? Whether we breathe it or spit it out, whatever, it's coming out. So, okay, so you're going to tell me that wearing a mask doesn't protect you because the person who is infected isn't expressing so much of it out of them, and you're wearing a mask, so you're not breathing in as much of it as you might without a mask. I mean, it seems to me you wear a mask if you really want to be safe. If you're sure about everyone in the room that you're with, that they're all vaccinated, no one's sick, then yeah, you don't need to wear a mask. So that maybe that makes Thanksgiving safe. But really, it just does not seem to me, what's the proverbial rocket science? It's not, you know, if it's a respiratory disease conveyed by particles expressed out of people's mouths and noses, then wear a mask.
There seems to be an uptick in new cases of coronavirus, positive cases in the county. Are you seeing the same thing, Liam? And why are we seeing these cases despite having the vaccine out there?
Yeah, I'm looking at the sort of the same dashboard you are, and I'm also looking at the portion where it says that 40,000 people in Sullivan County have completed their series of the vaccination, which sounds good until you remember that Sullivan County has around 75,000 people in it. So that's a little more than half. Yeah, it's not maybe where it should be. And I think what you said about the impact of masking regulations sort of falling away is could also definitely having an impact. There's a lot of things where maybe it's safe for you to do unmasked now if you are fully vaccinated. So I think a lot of people are assuming that things can sort of get back to normal. We can start having meetings in person again. We can start having like these great dinners or these celebrations or these large gatherings again, when even if you are masked and you are going, or you are vaccinated, sorry, and you are going to these meetings and it might be safe for you to do so, people who are unvaccinated will perhaps also be showing up to those meetings because they think they're safe or because they don't necessarily see as much risk from the virus as maybe someone who has been vaccinated. So it's an easing of restrictions, and it's sort of uncertainty about whether or not we can safely get back to normal, where maybe it's not quite safe yet with just vaccination rates being where they are. So I can definitely foresee the possibility that the numbers keep going up for a while.
And Joe, what does it look like in Sullivan County with the vaccine? Is it something that I guess we just all have to eventually start living with, like we pretty much live with the flu?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've gotten both my shots. I'm sure I'm eligible for a booster yet. I'm not at the 8-month mark, and I'm 29. So, you know, but as far as the shots go, look, to the point where Liam was saying that 40,000 people have completed their series, we have 75,000 people. You know, I think more people will slowly, hopefully, get vaccinated. But I'm also somewhat of the opinion that I think at this point, the people that haven't are pretty adamant against it. And I don't know if that's going to change. Maybe things will, unfortunately, as a lot of people are seeing more and more of their loved ones, friends and family who have had a tough time with the virus, perhaps that will change some things. But yeah, I think it's going to be around for a while. You know, switching to the vaccination effort side of it, starting this Friday at the Monticello Firehouse, the county's holding their first clinic for vaccinations for children ages 5 through 11. That was recently recommended or approved by the CDC and to move forward with that. So, you know, I think that'll help certainly because these kids didn't have the option before to even have the shot. But I've even seen on social media and other places that there's a lot of debate going on amongst parents for whatever reason, as far as having some possibly some reservations for wanting to have, you know, their 5 to 11-year-old vaccinated. We'll see how many people take advantage of those clinics, but I would think that the more kids that can be vaccinated would probably be for the better, because schools was the big question mark, you know, coming into this year with COVID cases, and, you know, these children have been home. I heard from a school official recently, just in conversation, that a lot of the COVID cases that are in schools are not so much from within the schools, but kids that are bringing it in from the outside. So, the school districts have been doing an amazing job with being able to, you know, contain COVID cases. But yeah, I think, though, as everyone's kind of saying here, I don't mean to be a pessimistic person. I try to be optimistic, but you know, like I said, I don't know. I think we're starting to see sort of a stable number in terms of the eligible people who have been vaccinated. And I think, you know, we're just going to have to see how this whole thing plays out, unfortunately.
Right, definitely. Now, switching topics here, it's almost the end of the year, and one thing that towns and villages have to decide on is whether they want to opt out of having a cannabis dispensary or on-site consumption site within their borders. Liam, you've been covering this for a while. You've been on Local Dish talking about this. Do you have an update for us on the cannabis situation in Sullivan County and in our listening area?
Yeah. In the towns I've sort of been covering the most that still had to decide on cannabis, Tustin and Coshecton, they both, in their most recent board meetings, voted to opt out of both dispensaries and on-site consumption places. I believe Highland is still working on what they're going to do. I don't know. I don't have indications from there which way they're going to go on it, but they are facing a pretty near deadline. I don't necessarily expect the Coshecton opt-out to be overturned. I think it's possible that there could be a referendum against it, but I haven't quite seen the energy from that, at least at the board meetings. But in Tustin, it's sort of become a culture shift issue, where a lot of the Democratic second homeowner type people in town have been showing up at the meetings and really advocating for dispensaries and for cannabis as being something that is incredibly useful and could bring in a lot of revenue to the town. And a lot of the perhaps more legacy people in town who perhaps lean more conservative have been saying, no, this is a gateway drug. This town has enough problems with opioids and addiction, and we don't need to introduce another drug into the community. So speaking from, I think, a very real fear, even if marijuana is fairly conclusively not a gateway drug, and that is going to go to a referendum. There's going to be a permissive referendum I'm pretty certain there's going to be one. I've talked with Brandy Marola, who's organizing the referendum, and she says she has almost enough signatures on the petitions to start that referendum, which would be a referendum to permit the local law opting out of dispensaries and or on-site consumption joints. So the town is going to get a chance to vote on this, and the energy in town seems to be very very tense about it. So I think a lot of people will turn out on both sides, and we're really going to get to see the full, like, the full spirit of the community in terms of where they stand on this.
I said, from what I understand, the law, the towns have to pass a local law to opt out. But if the towns do nothing, if they just sit there and do nothing as far as voting on this, that means they're automatically in. Is that correct? Am I understanding that correct, Liam?
Yeah, they have to pass in a local law by the end of the year if they want to opt out. Otherwise, it's just legal and they don't get the chance to opt out later on. They can opt back in if they choose to opt out. So you can say no now and say yes later. But if you say yes now, you can't say no later. And even if the town board passes a local law, that law is subject to permissive referendum from the people if enough signatures are gathered to make that be a thing. So that's what's happening in Tustin right now.
We're listening to the Reporters Roundtable with Patricio Rubio and local journalists from the region. We'll hear more from them after a short break, and we'll also check in again at the music sale about to get underway at the White Sulphur Springs Fire Hall. This is Radio Chatskill.
During another year of unexpected challenges, listeners like you helped Radio Catskill meet the moment. With your generous support, we came together for inspiration, connection, and essential information. We hope you'll include Radio Catskill in your year-end giving plans. Your support today leads to a greater tomorrow. Support us now and beyond by making your year-end gift now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
On this week's Wait, Wait, actor Stephen Fry tells us the downside of narrating the Harry Potter books.
A man yelled at me across the street when I was in London, "My children go to bed with you."
I'm Bill Curtis. Join us for the news quiz that's a lot less offensive in context. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and in about 20 minutes, less than 20 minutes, the annual music sale returns to the White Sulphur Springs Fire Hall. Jason Dole is there with a lot of our volunteers getting ready. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Tim. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Are you guys getting excited there?
I'm super excited. I mean, we're still 20 minutes away from the doors open, but the music sale is really picking up here because I just finished my first whole cup of coffee. So, boy, things are looking up. I was, on hold listening. Patricio conduct that panel. Patricio Rubio is here. He's here documenting what's going on. You might see some of his pictures and videos on the social media. He's on the Facebook Live from the music sale, so if you want to see what it looks like that way, that's where you can go to check it out.
Yeah, at WJFF Radio is our handle on Facebook and Instagram. Sorry.
But today we're really looking for people to come out here in person and get some of this stuff, and you're supporting your favorite radio station at the same time. I think that's something that we haven't really highlighted on this, but
yeah.
Just as we count on people to support us during the fund drives, we count on folks to make donations to this music sale and then to come out and get what their fellow neighbors and listeners donated. And, we've got almost 2 years worth of donations here at this sale. Because we weren't able to have the sale last year.
Right. And it is one of our more bigger fundraisers. So all of the donations that we receive are sold back to folks that have come to the music sale, and that money goes into our account. So it is important for our well-being. And also it gives you guys a great takeaway, some cool vinyl, some musical instruments. And it looks like there's a wall of sound there in the back with all the speakers we got donated.
Yes, yeah, and that's typically, and that's the area of the sale that David Dan always helps curate. And what he does is he checks all of the equipment that's donated. People donate CD players, record players, turntables, speakers, as you said, and there's always just a great display of stuff. And people have really gotten into building up stereos, even in the era of everybody using their iPods or phones or Spotify or whatever you have, people are building back their home stereo system. So people looking to do that on the cheap, this is one of the places where you can do that. You need some speakers, you're looking for a CD player, this is the place to come look for it.
You get a bargain and that money goes to us, so we thank you. Have you been able to talk to anybody in line yet? Or?
I spoke to the gentleman at the front of the line, and I'm bad with names, so and I didn't want to give his name on the radio anyway, but I've seen this gentleman at, like, every music sale. The first few guys on the line have pretty much been here, like, at every music sale that I've been to. And I said, why do you keep coming back? And these are people that have a real connection to the music. The first gentleman is here. I said, why were you the first person? He said, because I got up in the morning and I came. And likes music and is still looking for music, whatever catches his eye. And and then the gentleman right next to him, he's a dealer, and he's here looking for a deal, and he's going to find it. You
he's
know, the
find
people
it.
that run music businesses or are musicians are the types of folks that come out here to see what they can get.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff. And again, price to move. There's a $5 cover to get in, and then you get in to find a lot of bargains, and you're going to take away something great. And again, you're going to support your public radio station for the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. Just about 15 minutes to go. Jason, I'll let you go and get ready, and I'll see you over there in a little while.
All right, counting down, 15 minutes or so. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
And back to Radio Chatskill, we have our final portion of the Reporters Roundtable for November. Patricia Rubio speaking with our local journalists in the area this month, talking to Joe Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, Chris Rowley from the Shawangunk Journal, and Liam Mayo with the River Reporter.
Switching gears again, looking towards Sullivan County Legislature, Joe, I know that's something you covered, that's your beat. And this lately has been some controversy with the chairman and the legislature and how things are being run right now. Do you have a sort of an update for us and let us know exactly what's going on at the Sullivan County Legislature?
Yeah, so I guess not to take too long, but kind of setting up the background here for listeners. When the county transferred ownership of the care center at Sunset Lake to the Sunset Lake Local Development Corporation for the purpose of them trying to find a company to operate the care center, in the town of Liberty, the exemption, the tax exemption that was on that property came off. And according to the assessor in Liberty, the LDC did not apply for a new exemption by the deadline. So what occurred was this past September, LDC got a $226,000 tax bill that had to be paid for the property. And the county gave the LDC the money to pay that bill. And the county has since stated that Infinite Care, which is the company that was chosen and now operates the care center, has a contract with the county, will be the one to pay the reimburse them and will pay the taxes moving forward. With that said, there's been some discussion recently about possible omit property taxes for before, you know, sometimes it takes time for these transfers and stuff to appear on tax rolls and stuff. And so what had occurred was recently the chairman of the legislature, Rob Doherty, the county attorney, Michael McGuire, and two other county employees attended a Town of Liberty board assessment review meeting. It was after that meeting occurred, the town of Liberty issued a letter to the legislature stating some issues with the behavior, alleged behavior of the county representatives who were present. A couple of the allegations that were made by the town assessor in Liberty was that the chairman called her the C word and that county attorney called her stupid several times and engaged in bullying behavior. Those are all, at this point, allegations, and you know, as this whole process kind of plays out, there was a large contingent of the public that showed up at last Tuesday's legislature meetings because of Veterans Day. They held them on Tuesday instead of Thursday. There was a lot of public comment. Some of the public and fellow legislators, some of them had asked for the chairman to resign or for McGuire to resign based on these allegations, while other legislators, you know, kind of cautioned them. You know, legislator George Conklin had said that, you know, he agreed with a lot of the sentiments that people were saying around that word and how it's inexcusable to say, but that he wasn't sure yet that this event had happened. And Michael Brooks, another legislator, had said that he had spoken to some people less than a day after the meeting had occurred. And they had mentioned to him about the county attorney being, quote, aggressive, but nothing. He said he didn't hear anything about that word that was allegedly said. So as this whole thing kind of plays out, that, like I said, led to a very contentious meeting. You know, we're going to have to see how things unfold and also sort of the tax situation with this property. If the county or the LDC or such is going to move at some point to maybe try to put forth whatever application is necessary or whatever to see if they can get it tax exempt again. But as of now, Liberty Town Supervisor Frank DiMeo said no one had called as of last week the town attorney to discuss or have any or grieve the assessment. So that's sort of where we're at there. As far and one of the will be an issue sort of to look at going forward is especially considering in addition to this playing out, you know, the legislature, whatever backlash occurs from this, January marks 2 years since they were elected, which is when they reorganized. So we'll see whether or not, you know, the people in current positions, chair, vice chair, will remain in place.
Liam, I know you also cover legislature. What is your take on what's going on and the discord that's happening currently in the legislature? What is your view on it? Has all of this sort of become a distraction from the legislature actually doing the actual work of passing laws?
I mean, I think Joe did a really good job summarizing the issue. And I would just add, I think that I also agree with you, Patricio, about it being a little bit of a distraction, or specifically about the specific allegation of the C word being perhaps a little bit of a distraction, where there was a lot of support in the letters from the Town of Liberty for at minimum, slightly bullying behavior, slightly intimidating behavior. And even if that was not the case, there are still like very valid concerns about how the county is handling the care center and how the county is handling the taxation issues around it. And yeah, it a lot of business still needs to get done and still needs to be resolved around the care center. And these allegations are incredibly serious and definitely worth investigation. But there's also the allegations of misconduct in terms of everything that's gone on with the care center and with how it's been organized. So it's a sort of two-pronged issue where there's this one specific incident, but there's also this broader pattern around the care center. And I think both are important to keep an eye on going forward.
Definitely a lot of great points that you made there. Now, on a lighter note, Chris, there's a new attraction in Ellenville, I guess to say, in the theater district of Ellenville. What can you tell us about the theater there? And is everything back open again? Since the pandemic?
Well, we have an extension.
Yeah.
We have doubled our number of theaters. But what basically has happened is Shadowland, which has been running, well, about 30 plus years now and doing pretty well, has bought and brought into service another space on Market Street for a theater in the round. They call it a black box theater or theater in the round. They've done a really nice job, nice seats, comfortable, and four different views of the stage. I mean, you can choose where you want to be and you can see the actors from this angle or that angle. They had a play called The Niceties that ran there. It's a fairly dramatic play. The setting of this one is a student, an African-American student, comes in to discuss her PhD thesis with her advisor, and then it explodes into one way or another into a ding-dong battle over, you know, the same old line, right? You know, how is power expressed in this country? What is the legacy of the last couple of hundred years and so on? And I guess what I took away from it and what I hear from people is that it really has made people think, you know, which is good. That's what sort of a black box theater is about. More kind of critical, more kind of investigative, more kind of exciting kind of theater, perhaps in some ways, than just the entertainment value. Well, no, this is not being fair, perhaps, to a lot of Shadowland productions are also, you know, pressing hard on various social lines. But so that was really good. That puts a new theater on Market Street and increases the traffic of people moving up and down that block. And it's another sign of the village of Ellenville coming back to life. This is for our whole region. I mean, for everybody over in Sullivan County, too. This is a good thing. With Ellenville coming back to life this way, you've got a place to go for two theaters now. Two different shows will be running. experimental theater, you know, so maybe there'll be a competition with Forestburg, you know, I mean, there's some things that can happen. So, you know, that's a nice upbeat type of thing. I look at that and I'm encouraged, you know.
It's great that businesses like that are back on, and like in the city, Broadway is opening up again. It looks like Ellenville's same thing is happening. Before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on you guys would like to talk about? Chris?
Well, one thing I would just say is that tonight we have a planning board. I'm not sure yet what's on the agenda, but I think Chris Goland will be back again. And that's a very important application for the village of Ellenville and town of Worthing. Cresco Labs are applying for a 380,000 square foot facility to grow cannabis for the medicinal. They emphasize that at this point, there is no actual adult, you know, production in New York State. The Cannabis Control Board is going to be working all the details out of that thing as you go forward. But Cresco has a license for medicinal, and they want this facility as quickly as possible. And since it offers potential of a lot of jobs, and a real shot in the arm of, an economic boost for this area, it's an important thing to be watching. So looking to see whether that one comes back. And then the next one, other thing that we're looking at is the Precious River Valley, which is the revitalization, refurbishment, whatever you want to call it, of the Neverly into something completely new, a luxury high-end resort, which also will have a rejuvenating effect on the economy here.
I was going to add, it's just as like maybe a cliffhanger for our next roundtable, is it was expected that the president was signing the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. It will be interesting to see as we watch how much of that will funnel to our communities. I know in Tuesday's paper, I did a story on the county airports getting $790,000, as is Orange County. I'm not sure about what's going on in Ulster, but that's just the first piece that we know of, but it could be possible going forward that for, you know, it's all different kinds of things, transportation and infrastructure, how much of that will come to Sullivan and Ulster County.
Right, definitely. This is something we should definitely keep an eye on and see how it develops. Everyone, thank you for joining us for another edition of the Reporters Roundtable on Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricia Rubio. I was joined by Chris Rowley from the Shawangunk Journal, Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, and Leah Mayo from the River Reporter. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time. For Radio Catskill, I'm Patricia Rubio.
And that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can listen to this and other editions of Radio Chatskill on our website. Just go to wjffradio.org. There you'll also find our podcasts and other programs. And you'll find the community calendar. You'll find out what's going on this weekend, especially today, Small Business Saturday. Support local businesses in the region and support Radio Catskill. It's our annual music sale, which is getting underway in just about 2 minutes at 11 o'clock at the White Sulphur Springs Fire Hall, 3352 New York Route 52 in White Sulphur Springs. There's a $5 cover, mask required, and bargains galore. All of the proceeds benefit your public radio station, Radio Catskill. Thanks for listening. I'm Tim Bruno.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Liza Phillips Design, sustainably sourced natural fiber rugs for floors and stairs, designed in Narrowsburg, handmade in Nepal. By appointment and on the web at LizaPhillipsDesign.com. From Jeffersonville Bake Shop, offering breakfast and lunch to go or to stay, Tuesdays through Sundays. Also featuring Chi Hive Yoga's gentle movement class in the event space. JeffersonvilleBakeShop.com. Radio Catskill never stops growing and never stops appreciating our relationship with you. Whether it's broadening the world of new listeners or finding new ways to connect with what's happening where you live, your donations make everything we do possible. We hope you'll include Radio Catskill in your year-end giving plans. Make your year-end gift now to support public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania at WJFFradio.org.
On this week's On the Media, how the cassette tape brought down governments, collapsed space and time, and remade how we share information.
The idea that you could have your own compilation that you made, and you could have songs in any order you wanted,
It's like a sort of a superpower this technology was giving you.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Coming up this afternoon at 4, you can find cassette tapes and more at our music sale getting underway at 11 at the White Sulphur Springs Fire Hall. Mostly cloudy today with some snow flurries possible, ending around noon, high of 32. This is WJFF Jeffersonville. Farm and Country is next.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.